We have a special guest here today. I'm with Joe Principe, who is a business, finance, and corporate lawyer. He is fluent in Japanese. He's been involved in successful exits. He's worked with big, huge law firms. I know you're a partner now with a law firm that you're more closely and intimately related with. And this is an individual who has the experience to talk about a whole number of topics with regards to M&A. I really am grateful to have you here. I wanted to talk to you about, term sheets, LOIs, purchase agreements, subscription agreements for raising equity. We'll touch on debt financings through promissory notes. There's a whole bunch of stuff we want to touch on. It's going to be tough to go super deep on all of these, but hopefully we can shed some knowledge and some insight as far as what these items are, red flags, all that good stuff. But firstly, Joe, thank you for coming on. And I know we just real briefly touched on your background. Would you mind giving a little bit more of a proper introduction as to who you are and what your background is?
Yeah, hey, and I appreciate having me on, and I'm super happy to, give people some advice, tell people some key issues to keep aware of. A little bit about me. So I start off my career in M&A and finance. I'm in business. I started off at the number one international M&A and finance law firm, ex-US outbound transactions. So they do, like I was in Japan, we did stuff like Japanese people buying an Indian company. So that's what I mean when I say international. Americans don't do many international deals. That's one of the things about corporate law. And so I started off there in M&A, working on billion-dollar plus M&A transactions and financings. I went on to work at a top US company, US law firm, Baker McKenzie. So they're like top five US by revenue. And then I also clerked at the SEC. I did a few other things with big law firms, and I worked in some tech businesses. So I worked in this one business was the Elon Musk sort of Virgin Hyperloop One business that a lot of people have probably heard about. I was in-house counsel there, and I built a few of my own companies and sold those too. And now I am one of the things I'm doing with most of my time is I run a mid-market M&A boutique law firm. Called Optimist Legal, and optimistlegal.com is our website. And what we do is we focus mostly on acquisition entrepreneurs, guiding them, doing their legal work. So that's sort of my background.
Perfect. And I mean, we're right at the right place here. Most of the folks watching here are interested in M&A, doing acquisitions. And you're speaking with a lot of individuals who have a general business knowledge, or who have a general interest in finance and acquisitions, but don't have obviously the experience that you have. So again, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it. And I thought, if we start from the top, I mean, we could argue maybe you should start with discussing operating agreements, but I know most people here are most interested in the deal making itself. So I thought, tell me if you agree, but I thought maybe we'd start with, hey, you find this company, you're interested in this company, and hey, we've reviewed the financials, we reviewed the financial documents, and we want to make an offer. And we've figured out internally how much we want to offer. And so naturally, the first step, and I know you can probably provide some clarity of LOI versus a term sheet, but just speaking to that initial, perhaps we could start with that kind of conversation of how does one formally make, a legally binding offer?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I can understand this is the critical stage of the transaction where a searcher, acquisition entrepreneur, he's basically ready to go. He's got his business mindset and his business plans going, but he's encroaching on the legal space and he's got to be careful. He's got to protect his interests. And so, in relation to that, I mean, one thing I'd add just as a get-go is, there's a lot of these terms, heads of terms, memorandum of understanding, indication of interest, expression of interest, letter of intent. All these things are the same thing. Depending on the type of transaction or the jurisdiction, they use different words. There are these agreements. They're typically non-binding except for as to a few of the clauses. And so, if you want to make it binding, you can. That's actually up to you because under contract law, it's the freedom of the parties is the legal principle. So, you have freedom to write what you want in the contract within the guise of the law. So, you know, generally the rule of thumb is that the only terms that are binding in those agreements are the, you know, if there's a breakup fee, which is not common, the confidentiality clause, which is important. You don't want the seller to be able to share your information with his other potential buyers and work around you. Right. And the exclusivity or the not no shop provision, which again, if you're spending time and you're in, you want to do this transaction and you want the seller to work with you, you want to lock them up contractually. And that's what that exclusivity or no shop provision is all about. And those are kind of the, you could find a lot of examples of these provisions online, by the way, but the main thing is here, what I'm talking about is that you're locking up the seller to work just with you for usually a period of 60 to 90 days for the transaction. And you don't want them shopping around your deal. It's a waste of your time. That's kind of the key thing there. And it, frankly, if you're paying advisors at that time, you're going to be losing money. So that's why that provision's normal. That's a little bit in relation to key terms of the LOI and the binding nature of the LOI. You know, those are usually the only binding terms. Everything else usually non-binding. Why don't I throw it back to you to take us further?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And that seems to be what we always talk about internally with my partner, who, like you, has that legal background, where it's, hey, it needs to be, we need an exclusivity period, you know, where we can't get shopped, essentially, where you have a period of time where we work in good faith to really move then, you know, to a purchase agreement. And I know for some of these real small deals in our world, we do a lot of, like right now, we do a lot of these sub $5 million SBA deals, and a lot of the audience will deal with that too, where sometimes in that world, you don't even do the term sheet or the LOI. You go right to the purchase agreement. Yeah. The big bad world of M&A, it seems like it's more term sheets and LOI. So maybe if you could talk, because I know a lot of the audience is interested in the bigger M&A world of, you know, these 10, 20, 30, 50, $100 million M&A deals. There, it seems like there's, from my understanding, you normally have a term sheet. And then over time, well, sometimes it seems like simultaneous signing closes for the purchase. You sign the purchase agreement and then the deal closes. Whereas, you know, where we in the smaller world, you do these staggered sign and closes on the purchase agreement. So I don't know if you can provide some real broad stroke clarity on how the big bad world of M&A works versus these kind of micro cap deals that we're talking about.
Yeah, no, I definitely can. I have a few key points that I could say that can be very helpful for the audience. The first off is that the smaller the transaction you get, you see more skipping of the legalities. You see more, you know, skipping, you can call them formalities, but skipping of the formalities. But there's always the key point here is there's always a reason for each of these stages and each of these clauses and each of these agreements. There's a reason people doing bigger deals, and that reason does not disappear. It's because of the smaller deal. So if you're thinking, oh, I'll just skip the LOI, and 2 months later, the seller, even though everything seemed good, they sell the transaction to somebody else after you haven't even finished DD yet, or maybe you've wasted time in DD, then don't be surprised, because that's why you have an LOI. That's why you get an LOI with the no shop clause. So there's a reason for all these things, and I recommend people, even on smaller transactions, just to walk the step. Do the basic process, do the LOI, and then do the DD, and then sign the agreement after the DD is complete. Don't make any payments or sign anything until after you've done that, unless the DD is a condition to closing of the agreement. But even then, in these smaller transactions, you should do the DD before you sign.
DD for due diligence. I say, just to be clear.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that's because these smaller transactions have a tendency to have more issues on due diligence than larger transactions, because people are skipping formalities. Their accounting books aren't out of it, if they're even put together correctly at all. Yeah. And there's so many issues that do arise that, you know, I'm saying here, and I say, just stick to that process. It's not a big burden anyways. You know, get your form LOI that you know is right, and use it when you're buying various businesses. And it's, you know the process and do your process. So I don't think when you're dealing with these transactions, even if it's a couple million, that taking risks is the right way to go about things.
I love that. You know, it's funny. We we've always been instructed by the listing brokers, oh, skip the LOI step, go right to the APA. They always want you to go right to the purchase agreement. And we've not, we've followed the path that you're describing. And that's been, I hadn't thought comprehensively about the risks associated, but you're right. The one thing it does is it holds everyone's, kind of quote unquote feet to the fire for a period of time. So you can work in good faith to see if this deal can truly get done. Whereas going right to the purchase agreement, you put all this emphasis, all of this legal work into something that you may look under the hood then and quickly realize, at least from the buyer's perspective, from my perspective, you then get under the hood and you realize, I don't even want to do this. And we spent all this time negotiating this purchase agreement that, there was no point. So, I mean, it makes sense to me. Yeah. But that's great insight from your perspective with the experience.
By the way.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. And by the way, there's two points that I can touch on there real quick related to what you were just saying. So first of all, it's no surprise that the broker and the seller want you to sign right away.
Right.
That's in their interest. The broker, and these guys are great guys. This isn't a morality issue. It is merely their business to get you to sign that agreement.
Totally.
But it is not necessarily your interest to immediately sign that agreement if you're a buyer.
Yep.
So that's one point. And the second point is, it's really not uncommon to get in and look at these businesses and see, oh my gosh, they don't have any contracts for their revenue sources, or their supplier contracts are third rate. And a lot of people accept those risks, but that's not necessarily always the best decision. That's a lot of risk right there. And then you're going to have to do more DD, like customer interviews, which people do skip also. So there are significant risks there that arise that people should be aware of.
I love that. And I concur with you that generally, from my experience, the smaller the transaction, the greater uncertainty you have, and the more volatility you have once you look under the hood as far as what you're going to find. That's been my experience. There's some pretty interesting things. Emphasis on interesting. Interesting things you can find. When you get
right
on some of these deals. So I totally agree. But moving forward, for the sake of time, let's say you submit an LOI, it gets accepted, both parties sign it, you go into diligence, you start really getting under the hood. For the sake of moving this, well, maybe you want to comment on, do you have comments you'd like to provide on this intermediary stage before, because ultimately I want to take it to the point where, hey, you sign a purchase agreement now. I'd love to get your take on the purchase agreement, but do you want to talk about that intermediary phase between an LOI and a purchase agreement being signed by both parties?
Sure. Just to keep it short, I'll just mention one or two key things that come to mind during that phase. Firstly, as I mentioned before, the traditional path is this: you start DD and you start the contract negotiations, or you start preparing a contract. So traditional methodology is that you get on those simultaneously. However, it's not uncommon that DD doesn't start until after the agreement is executed, and satisfactory DD is a condition to closing under the agreement.
Right.
That's not uncommon also. But the key point there, really, I really want to touch on is, a lot of sellers, they want to rush people through DD, and they want to say they gave you everything that you asked for. And you kind of have to have, maybe you could get some DD lists online or from your lawyer, preferably, get and really know what you're looking for, because it's not uncommon for them to provide things that just are wrong. We have one transaction right now where the seller said there's only X shares. But they also said that there were many shares at a different point in time and through a different document. And so, well, how do you know how many shares you're even going to buy in a share acquisition situation? If you just listen to the seller, then you're going to be off to a really bad start. So I guess my summary of my point is that just be extra aware of during that intermediary phase or doing this DD stuff, that you're actually getting what you're looking for, and don't feel bad to go back again and say, no, but this is what I'm looking for. You shouldn't feel odd about that. That's very normal. To ask for the same thing four times is not abnormal. If they're not providing it, you need to get it. So just be aware of what you need to get and make sure you're getting it, and don't accept anything less, especially with corporate documents. If you're in a share acquisition situation, like, that is the thing you're buying, the company. It better be all put together accurately. You don't want somebody else to have owned some shares and you didn't buy those shares, but you thought you were buying the whole business. So that's a no bueno situation.
Certainly a no bueno situation. It's funny you say that. We have a deal under contract right now, and we're going through diligence. We started diligence before we got it under contract, and then continued diligence as a condition of closing that we're satisfied. But to that point, we've had to ask for documents. And I don't think it's anything malicious on the sell side. You're dealing with a big, long diligence list. There's a whole bunch of items. Often with these smaller mom and pop sellers, they've never gone through this process before. It can be overwhelming for them. At least that's been my experience. And, okay, you know, we've had to ask several times for things. And I think it's just one of those where things fall through the cracks. But it's funny. I mean, I'm going through this right now. So yeah, your comments, I can specifically vouch for and say it's true. And if you don't ask for it, then, you know, you've essentially, a sin of omission? You're missing a key item to go through diligence with. So,
amen. Yeah, you're taking on the risk of that issue, depending on how your agreements are structured. But yeah, no, exactly. And I agree with you. I never assume there's ill intent. Nonetheless, sometimes there is. So
yeah, there can be.
yeah, there can be it. And the bigger the deal, the higher things at stakes, and it happens a lot. The bigger the deal. Yeah. It actually isn't infrequent. It's not infrequent. So,
and even for these smaller deals, I mean, a lot of the folks you're watching or listening, you know, they're getting started. I mean, when I got started, I was broke, and even like you hear multi, you know, $1 to $5 million deal is considered in the world of M&A a very small transaction, and yet those amounts of that sum for an individual or a real small kind of startup group, I mean, this is meaningful stuff. This is really meaningful.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's still really, it matters no matter the size of the transaction. And then, you know,
yeah,
it's real. The risk is real. So I digress. We could talk more about all these topics, but to keep the ball short, yeah, respectful of your time, let's talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about purchase agreements. Let's say, you know, LOI was signed. Great. We went through some introductory diligence. So far, so good. Now, perhaps, you know, at least to use kind of these smaller deal paths, now everyone is prepared to sign a purchase agreement. Would you mind talking about just the big picture of it? Maybe talk about stock versus asset purchase agreements. I get that question a lot.
Yeah.
What would you provide as far as kind of big picture clarity on structuring a purchase agreement?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we could start off by letting everybody know that the most common way that you're going to be going about things in these smart transactions is not going to be these merger type things. It's going to be an asset purchase, a stock purchase, or a membership interest purchase. So the membership interest is if it's an LLC, and the stock purchase if it's a corporation. And so those are the three big transactions. You know, why do people pick one or the other? Well, between the equity acquisition, so between the membership interest or the stock versus asset, you know, it's easy to find this type of stuff online. There's a few basic considerations. You know, so I'm not going to talk about the seller's considerations, but sellers have an interest, either or, depending on their situation, because how the taxation occurs in relation to the assets or the sale is different based if it's a equity, so stock or membership interest, or if it's an asset. From the buyer's side, these are kind of the key points that you're going to be thinking about. You don't know what you don't know about some of these small businesses. They may have some liabilities that they haven't disclosed, and you don't necessarily want to be suing them for failure to disclose or for breach of the agreement. These liabilities I'm talking about, like maybe they had a product liability situation. There's all different ways one could have a liability. Maybe they had an outstanding loan that wasn't secured by the assets in this hypothetical. And so people often pick an asset purchase because you're not taking all the liabilities of the entity with you. If you buy the entity, you get all the liabilities with it, unless you carve them out, which you know, you don't. That's just a whole nother step. So asset purchase, you just get to pick what you want. Say you just, okay, this is the part of the business that I know is important. I'm just going to buy this part. That gives me a little bit of security of my peace of mind, I wanted to say. That, okay, I know that there's not something hidden. You know, a lot of the documents weren't really well put together. These mom and pop deals, you know, they don't do all the corporate formalities. I'm just going to buy these assets. Transferring titles, a very straightforward and publicly recorded thing. So you know you're going to get these assets, you're secure. That's one aspect, the liability. Another key aspect, I guess, what's big one number two? I don't know. For me, this isn't necessarily what people say is big number two. For me, it's the simplicity of the transaction. I don't know. Maybe people don't see this unless they do a couple of them or several of them. But when you just do a stock purchase, it's super straightforward. The DD is so it's more straightforward with an asset purchase. Now you have all these title. You have to transfer the assets. You have to get new. You have to get the workers' comp situated. You have to retitle the assets. You have to get the business insurance situated. You have to get the holding company situated. That's going to be acquiring the assets, unless you already have one. You have to get any business licenses set up. Any reseller certificates. There's so many things that people kind of take for granted. And they say, oh, an asset purchase is the way people say to go. I want to do that. But if you just buy the stock or the membership interest, all that stuff's already done for you. Yeah, you don't have to do anything.
Yep.
So that's my point number two for you.
By the way, I have to interject. I'm so glad you brought that up because I didn't have any understanding of that until I'd thrown myself into doing an asset deal. And then you're like, oh my God, there's about 100 things to hook up. You're giving your EIN to 100 different people. You're every single vendor, everything. That is the big downfall operationally. Those 2 to 3 months right around the period of an asset. And then we did two at one point, same day. And then you really, you know, I'm surprised I even still have hair after that. It was a lot. So,
oh gosh.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you. Because it's relevant and it does take up time and energy.
That's it. And I'm happy that you can vibe with me on that because so often it's, you know, there are reasons to do either, but hey, like smoothness of the transition period, we call it post-merger integration, the PMI. The smoothness of that is very important. Like, you shouldn't be creating more work for yourself. Indeed, you just kind of want to let the business keep moving. Like, that should be your objective. The business is going. I'm going to let all of these wins that are happening keep going because that's where I'm getting my profit at the end of the year. I want that. You don't want to be getting your hands in and turning everything over. And that's not the point. I mean, sure, you can do growth, but growth isn't supposed to be, you're not supposed to, I don't know. You know what I'm getting at. So.
Yes. Now, again, though, you don't have the liabilities. That's nice, right? But yeah, you do all that. You have a ton of post-close integration headache. There is the taxable. And I know this is really more of a accounting question, but my understanding is there are legitimate tax benefits for doing an asset deal relative to a stock or a membership interest transaction. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, no, there are. And that kind of goes back to the person's tax situation or the business's tax situation. One thing to keep in mind is that when you buy it, this is kind of the con of the other side of what you're saying. There's benefits on the asset side. People always talk about that. But if you think about the benefits on the stock side from a tax perspective, you don't get to acquire any of the So say the business has a lot of tax credits, but they have a lot of good things going on in their tax that could be used like NOLs that can be in future years, they have some tax that they can use to offset any other costs or stuff later on. I'm not trying to get into tax.
And I know
I'm not a tax. Okay. And I'm not a tax lawyer.
Right.
So I'm, yeah. So I'm just speaking to the very basic points here.
Sure.
So when that happens, when you buy assets, you don't get any of that stuff.
Right.
So, you know, the next year rolls around, maybe they had a lot of good tax credits or a good tax situation going on. There's a lot of things that could be. So I'm being very general that you could have applied to the following operating years.
Yep.
And you don't get to do that in asset purchase. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
Yeah. Well, and you said NOL. I didn't mean to interject there, but I'm 99% sure that's a net operating loss. So you're carrying your taxable losses forward. And then you would also recently, we took advantage of this, and it's something that you can look for. There was the ERC, the Employment Retention Credit, that I've heard of folks applying those to stock deals that they do. And hey, prior owner didn't take advantage of that ERC, and then you file the ERC, and you know, there's, I don't know. I have not had that happen for an acquisition I've done, but I've heard others. So yeah, that's a hell of a point. I didn't think of that, but you're right. That's a great point.
Yeah. It's, you know, people usually should, it is recommended that people get their tax advisor, or if it's a tax accountant, or whatever they're doing on the advisory side, that they talk to them about the transaction. That's kind of another one of those things that in the smaller deals, people kind of want to skip over. And they're, you know, they're getting a lawyer is already something they may not be familiar with, an acquisition lawyer. It's kind of like you're buying a house without your real estate broker. It's not something I'd recommend. You know, and it's quite a big deal. Right. You should definitely have a broker. A lot of people don't. My dad's a broker, so I'm very familiar with the circumstances. Some people do it without one, but you know, for sale by owner type situation. But what I'm getting at there, I suppose, is that, you know, you really should take into consideration the value that your advisors are adding. And on the tax side, there's definitely a lot of input you should be getting from your tax advisor.
No doubt. Okay. So we've talked a little bit about the purchase agreements here. I know for those listening or watching, I've spoken in a separate video about some of the business items that we look for. I made a couple of big mistakes. Love to see the pup there, by the way. I've made a couple. Just a huge monstrous head just shows up. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Fair play. But no, there's a video I made that talked about some of the items that I think are really important. Some of these small deals, they don't include what real M&A lawyers would call working capital, a la the receivables and the age payables, like the basically the cash flow of the business. A lot of these smaller deals, they try to sell you the business cash-free, debt-free, and without AR or an AP. And if you're dealing with a business that has a meaningful cash flow cycle, that can become a really significant item. I know that because I made that mistake firsthand.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Do you have a moment? Would you be able to tell a little detail?
Yeah. That? So the punchline, I thought I did my calculus correct as far as the cash flow of the business. And I thought basically that not including the AR in the business was justified because of the basis that the business was bought at, which actually I don't think it was a matter of the business being misvalued. I believe I own the business to this day. It's been a good business, but this was a business doing some specialty contracting work that had realistically about 60-day full cash flow cycles and was dealing with, you know, hundreds of thousands worth of AR. And I thought I had the correct amount of working capital. I should really just say an operating cash to get through that until I built my AR and built a cash flow position. I do this because you're like in a cash flow cycle where you're paying out, but money's coming in and you're in flow. Without the AR and the AP, you weren't. So punchline is I barely had enough operating capital. I thought that because the lender blessed it, you know, obviously they wanted to actually send me into the deal with significantly less cash. And I told them, I said, I think you know, I said, this is, I appreciate the commitment letter, which is the letter the lender will give you when they're ready to basically commitment to lend. You know, I'll never forget the day. I said, I really look forward to doing this deal with you. I appreciate the commitment letter, but you're trying to take an extra $60,000 of my cash and pledge it to the down payment. I'm not comfortable with it going to a down payment. I want to have that liquid because this business has serious cash needs and I have to build a position. And they came back the following Monday and agreed, and we signed that updated commitment letter. But both of our calculus was totally wrong. They were even more wrong than I was. And had I not vouched for that extra 60 or so thousand, I mean, for a business of this size, you don't want to get down to five figures in operating cash. And we certainly got to that point. And I didn't have any legitimate net worth at the time to pull from or cash to pull from. So it was dodgy, you know, is the short of it, and far from recommended and nerve-wracking, but we got through it. You know, we got through it, but it taught me a lot. So there's some certain things you really want to be thoughtful of. Licensing agreements, if you do an asset deal, is another one I know from firsthand experience. You make sure you're licensing. You have like a path to ensure that you're able to operate legally in the state and jurisdiction that you're in. So there's some other stuff.
Or then suddenly, how are you generating that capital to keep paying your bills?
Yeah.
That, by the way, that's a heinous story. I can imagine it must have felt like you're in that risky business situation the timing, and if the customers are being late in their payments or something, or however the business is, I think the general takeaway there is don't make too many assumptions. That's why there's generally a generous working capital period. And be very careful. Like, when you're in situations that can result in big problems like that, just be extra careful. Give yourself a huge buffer. Or, I mean, if you're getting a loan, for example, they might not approve a huge buffer, but whatever it is, like, give yourself the space. And that space will, if you didn't need it, that just means you're in an even better financial position.
Yep.
As opposed to, you know, being in a really bad one.
So. Yeah. Amen. I couldn't agree more. And I thought I was putting myself, by saying no to the lender and asking for the extra 50 or 60, I figured now I'm really cush, you know, now I'm really in the it couldn't have been further from the truth. But another one I think that's worth mentioning, especially for these smaller transactions, is don't take the professional opinion of a lender or even an advisor totally to the bank, because my story quite literally signifies that, you know, you have a professional lending institution providing on, you know, lending letterhead that everything is blessed and such. And it wasn't. It just, had we gone with the way they wrote it up, it would have been even worse. So you cross your T's, dot your I's, and as they say in the trades where I'm in, measure twice, cut once, you know?
Yeah. Hey, you know, I agree completely with that. And there's something I'd add there. First of all, it is quite surprising that happened to you, you know? Like,
yeah,
you definitely could have made the assumption, you know, these guys are literally a bank.
Right.
You know, they're the ones that should know this. It's a good thing for acquisition entrepreneurs to keep in mind that if you're dealing with smaller banks, the people are a little bit different depending on the size of the bank, to kind of put it frank. And the same thing goes with legal advisors. And so you got to be really careful. If you're dealing with a small town lawyer, and no offense, like, good people, nothing wrong with them, but they might not have had that big firm New York killers in New York type M&A experience. And that's the experience that's going to have that. That's going to the experience that's going to your lender. If you had like a city or something, they would not make that mistake, you know,
right.
Whoever it is. And same from the legal side, you know, be really careful. Like, if you're depending on your lawyer for something, and, you know, maybe he hasn't worked at a big firm doing M&A, like, you know, that's a huge, that's something to really be aware of. If you worked at some mid-sized firm and did M&A for 10, 15 years, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's nothing to balk at. But in the legal profession, you know, for non-lawyers out there, which is probably most people, something to be very wary of. The caliber is night and day. It's kind of scary, actually. It's like going to Johns Hopkins doctor or going to a small town general practitioner, GP. He might be a great guy, but he's not a Johns Hopkins doctor. And he's not going to, he's not going to have the same solutions. He's not going to see the same problems. So that's something people need to be ultra aware of. I see it all the time that people just don't know that. So something to call out.
I love that. My business partner, who has extensive experience at those top legal firms, and that was something I looked for. I did have the insight to get that one right. But I will say on the other side, and I say this if my partner's watching, and I say this with love because he and I are real close, but he took that working on $50 million to $5 billion deal sizes mindset and intensity to the smaller and just blew people up because it's cut. He has the 917. Isn't that the New York, the 917 area code on his phone? Like proper New York lawyer.
He's a New Yorker. Proper.
And is just terrified some of these smaller brokers and lenders. And I had to tell him, hey, I love it, but let's make sure we don't rip the relationship raw, because a couple of stories that I'll hold close to vest, but there's been a learn. You know what it is, you know, it's such a different world. This is why I keep trying to make this conversation with regards to the smaller M&A deals and then these, you know, $100 million M&A transactions. There's just so many differences I've learned in working with my partner, and similar to what you're talking about, Joe. It's just, there's a lot of nuance. So, you know, that's what we're hopefully trying to shine a little bit of light on too. But I agree. I mean, he's a true world-class professional and has worked at these legitimate places like yourself. And that was one of the reasons when I saw your resume, I said, this is fantastic, because you can tell there's no hiding when you're dealing with these huge private equity, huge clients and stuff like that.
Yeah, they're vicious. They're out to maximize their gain. And they'll apply their intelligence in every way possible. If they're working, 12 plus hour days, around some of the best professionals in the world in that field, it's no surprise that they're just going to be really good at it. Yeah. And so it's I'm happy you get what I'm talking about that New Yorker experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I laugh about it. I live on the West Coast currently, and it's funny to me because I'll call it a huge cultural difference. I'll call it that.
Yeah, certainly. Good stuff, really good stuff. I think this will be extremely valuable for the audience. And I appreciate, again, Joe, you being here. A couple of things I wanted to touch on before we let you go. I don't want to hold you too long. I know you're guy, it's a Friday. But if we can touch briefly, okay, so let's start from the top. We found a company we like. We put in an offer through an LOI. It got accepted. We've done diligence. We've looked for these red flags. We've said, okay, we're good with it. We've made a determination that we want to move forward with, and it's probably as stated in the LOI, whether it's going to be an asset. I'm pretty sure in our deals, we generally specify in the LOI if it's going to be an asset versus, you know, a stock or actually a membership interest deal if it's an LLC, but I digress. But anyways, we then work on the purchase agreement, negotiate that back and forth. My experience is that goes back and forth a couple of times between buyer and seller. They pass it back and forth, negotiate these items, yada, yada, get it signed. Now, we're to the point where we got to go raise capital, you know, ostensibly. Mm-hmm. Let's assume for a minute that we're not going to self-fund. Most people on this want to raise capital from debt and equity sources. Would you briefly talk about, you know, the legal instruments associated with raising debt and equity and some real, you know, broad stroke thoughts that you would implore people to think about when raising capital?
Yeah, definitely. Happy to do that. I guess a first point of note is that a lot of the people that may listen to this are probably going to be doing SBA lending. Is that correct?
There's a good chunk that certainly will. Yep.
Okay. So one thing I'd like to note there, well, obviously, you know, the SBA lender is going to be providing their form lending agreement.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's that. I mean, not to get into that, but to get into something closely related, which is that the SBA terms are very strict. If you want to satisfy for an SBA loan, the way your transaction is structured has to fit it, their rules. And the rules are, they're very strict. So you should become familiar with their rules. If it takes even a couple days of reading the SBA rules online or more than a couple days, you should do it. You should set that time aside. You should get really familiar with it. You should become conversant in it. Because when it comes to your options for how you can structure the transaction, it's severely delimiting. For example, you're limited. So you have to buy 100% of the business. You're limited in the way you can structure an earnout from the seller. If you want the seller to retain a portion of ownership interest, if it's a stock purchase, can't do that. Right. You can, however, pay them out on a consultancy basis. So you'd offer them to pay them in that way, or through the seller note. So that's something to keep in mind. Like if you're doing SBA, just become familiar with the rules. I'm more familiar with big transactions than with SBA transactions. But they're pretty straightforward, honestly. So a second thing to get into there, I guess, is the seller financing, very commonly used in a lot of these smaller transactions. And what that's done through is through a promissory note is the name of the instrument. And I will go ahead and talk a little bit about this, the instrument, because it's something that you should be drafting if you're a buyer. And it's not something necessarily that an SBA lender is going to provide you with their form agreement in relation to. So with this promissory note, what's important about this promissory note? But first I'll throw it back to you. Is there anything you'd like me to, I mean, I'm going to speak to a few of, you know, the key things that people should be aware of that are market standard. I'll ask you real quick. Is there anything you'd specifically like me to touch on or is that okay? Does that sound good about something to talk about?
Firstly, I think you're spot on as far as the kind of where the conversation's going, and I'll pass the baton back to you. But one thing I'll say just before I do is amen with regards to your comment on the SBA being very strict in what they do allow. I'll give you one more example for the audience here, and then Joe, pass back the promissory notes, because I've done a few of these SBA negotiations and whatnot. We're working on a few right now. And one example, another one. So we talked earlier about how it's so nice to integrate through a stock or a membership interest agreement because of the ease of the transaction. Well, here's a little weird fluff for you. And I learned this the hard way. If you do a stock deal, then the SBA requires every single equity holder in the acquiring entity to personally guarantee joint and severally, which I believe means entirely, like every, even a 1% holder has to be entirely potentially responsible for this. And so they basically make it all but impossible. There's some workarounds in quotes, and that's for another time, another place. But it almost makes it impossible for you to do a stock deal if you're doing an SBA transaction without some serious creativity. There's ways to get around it, but it's a very much restrictive item. I geek out a bunch about SBA deals because they're easy lob tosses, in my opinion, as far as government-backed financing to get your first deal done. The lenders are a lot less strict. They're also sometimes a little confused, a la the working capital problem I had prior. So there's pros and cons. But with that, you know, seller finance transactions or, you know, commercial financings, I think are quite possible for your first couple of M&A deals, which most of the audience is. And so I think you're right on the spot as far as talking about seller finance promissory notes, if you pick up on it. But okay, I just want to double back and say you're right. And there's a lot of this stuff you have to think about going in. But anyway, on the promissory notes.
Okay, cool. No, I think your anecdotes are really great. One thing I need to do better is try and give some examples. That's what my partner, Omid, always tells me to do, but I'm still a student in many ways.
Well, you provide the technical and I'll provide the, these are the goofy things I've done stories, and we'll be a
heck of a team. I love you've run straight through and had those practical experiences and seen it firsthand, and you learn from it though. So sure, it might have been like, but hey, you learn from it. And that's what, you know, makes you as an expert and being able to kind of tell other people a little bit here or there. And and say, hey, here's the guideposts, etc.
Right. No, no doubt. Certainly.
And so, you know, to get into the promissory notes a little bit, I'll talk about a few. I'll talk about some of the general points, not to be a lawyer. I could talk about them for hours. But I'll talk about some of the general points and then some of the things that happen. So, hey, I mean, you know, there's the tenor. So how many years? Well, okay, firstly, like, when are you going to start payment under it? You know, if you're also doing an SBA loan, the SBA lender may require that you don't start paying under anything else, including under the seller note, for a couple of years. Depends how many years in the transaction on the lender, really. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Like, when can you start payment? Well, you tell the seller, hey, I can't start paying you until 2 years later because my lender said so. That's something. That's one of the important terms of payment. Another thing is the tenor. So how many years during which will you be making repayment of the sum of the note? You know, that's variable. Depends on the transaction. I recommend people to try and maximize the duration of that. Don't get hopeful and say, oh, I'll repay you in 2 years. Hey, if the transaction really allows for that, and maybe the seller note was really tiny and it's not a big deal, then that makes sense. But on the other hand, you know, it's in your best interest as a buyer to have as long as possible, over as long term of, as possible, to make repayment of that sum and negotiate for as long as you can. Don't be unreasonable. But, you know, up to several years is totally accepted in many transactions. So don't think you need to be doing 2 years or something necessarily for the tenor. In other words, payment period is what I'm referring to.
In other words, like the term. Yeah.
Yeah, the term, in other words.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's what I'm talking about there. The interest is obviously another key term, the interest rate. You know, there's a market standard typically like 4 to 6%. You know, again, it's in your interest to get the smallest interest rate possible. Start off at 3, start off at 2.5. If you know, you're supposed to be, you're as the business guy, running your own transaction, you know, you talk to the seller and really get a feel for them and really talk to them and try and get the best term you can there. Get the lowest interest rate you can. They say it has to be 6. Talk to them and you'll be like, oh, you know, I'd really like it. Talk to them again. Oh, I'd really like it. Be your little own warrior on all the terms, not in an unreasonable or aggressive way necessarily. And so, you know, try to get the best terms you can. Moving on, you know, the seller note, promissory note for the seller is going to have, it's going to take security over the assets in an asset transaction or the shares of the business. In a share or, you know, membership interest transaction. When I say shares, I am referring to stock. Those two terms are used interchangeably. And so that's what I'm referring to. They'll take a security interest. They'll have a lien. If it's an asset purchase, they'll take a lien against, for example, the title, a lien against the assets. That's something to keep in mind. That's standard. I'd recommend if you're a buyer, start off without that term in there. It is market standard, but again, you know, your objective is to get the best terms you can. What you can do instead of having that in there is start off with just that you're going to be paying penalty. This is another term. Hey, during the any, if you don't make payment on time, you have to pay a penalty interest rate. So that's another term that's pretty common, but. You know, have that as your main go-to if things don't go forward, that people have to pay that you have to pay penalty interest, not necessarily that they can repossess, take back the assets on default. But that's another key term. I guess one of the final key terms I'll touch on is the terms of default. So what does it mean for you not to make payment under the agreement? What does it mean for so if you miss your payment date, what happens, or how do we define that? And so to give you some examples of events of default is one is you miss your payment date. Another one is the company's going bankrupt. So That's a common term of default. Another one's if you're restructuring the business. That's another common term of default. And a few other ones. So what's the takeaway here about, and I call them events of default. That's not what everybody calls them. That's sort of the legal proper way to say it. What are defined as the events of default under the seller note? And it's something to take away here is have them as limited as possible because you're the buyer. You want there to be as few ways you can default under this note as possible. And again, I'm not saying to be unreasonable and I'm not saying to, I mean, it's your option. It's again, the principle of contract law, freedom to contract. You get what you can. I'm not advising people to shark sellers. I'm not advising that. I think people should always be in very good faith. But, you know, put some events of default in there that are very sensible to you and not necessarily extremely broad. Now the seller's counsel will come back and they'll be revising these things. That's the onus is on them to do that. And if they come back and make it a little broader, that's completely okay. But at least you would have done your best and tried to get the best terms or the most reasonable terms for your situation that you could. And so why is that important? Well, if you default and you lose everything, that's a really big deal for you. You don't want that to happen. So you want to really make sure it doesn't happen. I like to put default periods, like non-payment periods. So like if this thing's happening, you have 30 to 60 days to fix it. I like to have those periods pretty long, 60 days, 90 days if you can get it. You could say the market standard's like between 20 and 40. It really depends. It's around 30 is not unreasonable. Around 30 days. Yeah, you know, 30 days to make payment for a missed payment. That sounds pretty standard and pretty reasonable. Asking for 60 days gives you more cushion. So keep that type of thing in mind. If things go wrong, do you want to be on the line for 30 days? You know, again, we were talking earlier about these situations where you're like, oh, crap, when you're on the nerves.
Right.
And this is one of those situations where you can give yourself a buffer and because your goal is to repay that seller note. So you're aligned, you know, you want to pay that note, but sometimes if you need 60 days because something happened in the business, you'll thank yourself later. You'll thank yourself that you gave yourself that buffer. I know I got a little technical there. I was trying to speak in common parlance about some of these legal issues. But I think that my point was clear and now I'll throw it back to you. What do you have to say about that?
No, I was taking notes here. That's really good stuff. I mean, you're talking about giving as much flexibility as possible in these promissory notes. It's a promise to repay, but within that, what is the promise? And you get to define that. Well, and if you take the draft, if you draft it, I thought you brought up a point too, that if you draft it as the debtor, you lawyers always fight, from my understanding, for first pass. Who's going to take the first pass at the document, right? You get to craft.
Yes, they do.
You get to craft the foundation of what we're dealing with here. So I think that was a subtle but really important point as well. It's always preferable if your party and your side gets the draft first. But no, I think that's super applicable. I love your call to action to start at a 2.5% to 3% rate. I mean, to be frank, that's something I can do and we could do better. We tend to go a little higher. And I'm thinking back, I'm thinking, why? Like, and you know, I kind of share a mini story here. We made an offer just a week ago, which actually was accepted. It was an LOI that was accepted. And I mean, it was a fair offer. It really was. But, you know, the market has shifted a bit. There's a bit more fear in the market relative, certainly, to like a year ago. Liquidity is tightened up. You know, quantitative easing is no longer, you know, things have changed. And so we, in our offer, made our offer reflect some of these changing times, and the terms were a bit more favorable to us as a buyer. And you know what? It was accepted exactly as our offer was accepted exactly as drafted. There were no changes. There wasn't a counter. And sometimes there are counters and sometimes they're not. But if you're negotiating against yourself, if you don't give yourself the best play, and that's, and I've committed that sin personally.
Yeah. Everybody does.
Yeah, and why do this? Why do it? That's a great point. I love
it. No, I think, and just to add in a little bit there, I think that's a really powerful story. A lot of people think, oh, you know, I'm not going to get that, so I'm not going to ask for it. That's a very backwards way of thinking. You're not like, don't be a dick about it. Just be very respectful and reasonable. And like you said with that story, and it's something for people to reflect upon, is that when the markets change, so do terms of the standard deal terms or what buyers and sellers can get. And that's a powerful lever to raise in negotiations, is to say, okay, this is the market conditions, or okay, these are the business's conditions. Those are all the things you should be thinking about as your arguments for your negotiable points.
Yep.
And in that story in specific, you know, it sounds like you did exactly what you should have done, is, you know, ask for terms that were good, that are there, you know, you're going to be able to satisfy them. Again, like, just kind of keeping things really fundamental, not get too fluffy about it. Like, you can do this. This is good. The market reflects this. Why not? That's a good mentality. A lot of people, especially in the smaller deals, there's actually a lot less back and forth. In the big deals, like, you'll get three back and forth on something like that. And then you'll have to push your point. You'll have to really express yourself. You'll have to say, hey, okay, I know you guys are asking for more, but this is why I did that, because of the market. And they'll say, well, what do you mean? You know, however that conversation goes out. So that's something that people should, even if they're not, you know, first time buyers or something of a business, they should really kind of, you know, if it takes a little building up of confidence to speak, or if it takes just kind of clearing their mind to speak, they should really just be willing to, they should really be willing to express themselves.
Amen. I love that. And, you know, just real quickly, I'll say, we've seen, I've commented on this a number of times, but even in the last 120 days, we've seen a change in a lot of deals have come back to contract. They fell out of contract. The buyer couldn't perform, rising interest rates. It's feeling more and more like a buyer's market relative to the past. Now, I don't have as much of a comment on larger deals, the $50 million deals.
That is happening. That is already happening in the bigger deal market. There's already a drying up.
Yeah. Times are changing. So ask for what you want. Amen. Good stuff. No, I mean, I think that covers the promissory note. I would just say I've seen debt financing documents that are 4 pages long. They're 2 pages long. I've seen them be 20 pages long. If it's an SBA deal, the lender is drafting that. There's not, from my understanding, there's really not any negotiation about like an SBA finance. Not, you don't get the first.
They're usually reasonable.
What's that?
Sorry. I was just saying, and they're usually reasonable. They drafted. It's usually pretty reasonable. You
know? Yeah. Yeah. That 1% holder has to guarantee the whole loan. Super reasonable. Nothing to worry about. Sign. I insist. Yeah. Not a problem.
There's that part.
Yeah.
The personal guarantees, the PGs. The rule for the audience is never sign a PG. This is something you learn in law school. Never sign one ever. If an SBA loan, though, I mean, you have to. So you take what you can.
Yeah. And I always was taught never sign a PG, never sign a PG. You don't want to. Have I? Yes. Do I regret it? Not as of today. No, I mean, not that I expect that I will, but you know, it's not ever a preferable thing. Business and entrepreneurship is about risk for your rewards. So I don't know, every entrepreneur gets to make that decision. But I think, you know, counsel is wise to advise their client not to sign a personal guarantee whenever possible, by definition. But but then you get to decide what are the, you know, what are the pros and cons. So anyways, we can talk all day. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in this section here, Joe talks about reps, warranties, and indemnification clauses in purchase agreements. We had a little miscommunication here, but he talks about how to basically protect yourself in a purchase agreement as a buyer. So pay attention to this. And then after this section, we're then going to talk about equity raising and how to structure equity investments. So let's dive into it.
Let's talk about the agreement generally and standard terms of the agreement that you should kind of keep an eye on. Well, I suppose, I'm pulling a classic lawyer thing where I was going to say they're pretty basic, but you know, if you're the one drafting them, I suppose they are. So, you know, the reps and warranties and the indemnity provision are the real big ones to be looking at. And tertiarily, the conditions to closing are extremely important. To touch very quickly on that third point, the conditions precedent or the conditions to closing, you really want, this is the go-to thought. You want to think, what is everything I want in place before I have to pay the seller? Everything I need to have, I want all of my boxes checked. And every single one of those things should be listed in your CPs, your conditions precedent. If you leave it out, and in bigger deals, this can be this is very serious. It can be very serious if you leave one thing out, crap can hit the fan. The smaller deals, people, the sellers are very usually amenable, and they'll make sure stuff gets done. In a bigger deal, they'll force you to pay. If you didn't get that one thing you forgot to put in there, they'll force you to pay anyways. That's what they're supposed to do. So you really got to make sure everything is written explicitly in the CPs that you want done. If it's transfer of title, etc. So just don't miss anything there. I know a lot of people do skimp over that on smaller deals, and the sellers are nice a lot, and people aren't too concerned. You know, that's a lazy mentality. That's a way to set yourself up for loss. Yep. It's a dangerous mentality. So to kind of touch on some of the other points from the reps and warranties, and this is something that people kind of, I'm gonna say something here, and at risk of getting too deep into the legal, I'm gonna say something here that I think will be very helpful for people. People kind of look at reps and warranties and they think, gosh, there's a lot of jargon going on over here. And I think this is the mindset you should go into when you're thinking about your reps and warranties. You should be thinking to yourself this. Okay, under contract law, the seller told me something. He said, oh, this is, the business has this in it. He told it to me verbally, maybe not in writing. He told that to me. I can rely on what he said. But what he said is not written in the reps and warranties. Well, what is a representation? A representation is a statement. A statement is something that is said. So the reps and warranties is everything. Usually there's a clause that says, if it's not written here, it's not part of the agreement. So if he said it, but it's not written there, it's not part of the agreement. You cannot go back and sue him, even though he said it. And so that's a big problem there. So what happens when people say things wrong, there's a breach of contract and there's a claim for misrepresentation. The cause of that, and I'm not a litigator, by the way. There's a fly bottom. I'm not a litigator, by the way. But so you have to be thinking, well, if what he said is wrong, or is what is written here wrong, how do I get my money back, or how do I protect my downside? And that's by bringing a suit under the terms of the reps and warranties. So you're going to bring a claim for breach of warranty, a claim for, by the way, obviously every state uses slightly different words and the law is slightly different here in the States, same for that everywhere else. And so you're going to bring a claim for breach of warranty or a claim for misrepresentation or a claim for breach of contract. And the causes of action, as they're called, are a little bit different everywhere. So that's kind of the mindset is, okay, well, what am I relying on here? And what is this transaction? What do I think it is? What was I told is here? The LOI might have said something, but the LOI is, again, not in your SPA, your subscription agreement or your share purchase agreement. The LOI is not in there. So it might say something. He might have said something. That is, we call it in law. That is not within the four corners of the agreement. And you have to be really careful relying on those things, reliance. That's kind of the mindset. Okay, what do I want to make sure the seller, what is this transaction? Make sure it's listed in the reps and warranties. And so you'll kind of, to give you a really basic example, if there's some real property assets like a warehouse or a factory or something, there's going to be a thing in there that says there's no environmental problems. All the environmental laws are satisfied. This is a huge deal. So if you come to learn later that there's huge environmental issues, oh my gosh, you can be forced to shut down your whole operation for very long periods of time, for many months, just for that one little issue alone. So if you're buying property, you know, like, okay, there's a rep. He said everything was good. He said there's no problems with the property. I'm just going to rely on him. That's a bad mindset. Instead, you should be thinking, he said that, but let's make sure it's in writing. Let's make sure this clause here says that there's, it says all that stuff. There's nothing wrong with the property. And if that happens, you get to sue him, you get your money, or whatever the remedy that is set out, you know, you get a remedy. So that's like the, I having worked on a lot of these infrastructure projects, like, you know, buying and selling oil and gas fields or LNG refinery financings, et cetera. Something that is really close to heart is these environmental issues, yeah. The satisfaction of the environmental laws. It's very common for people to, if it's an older piece of property, not if it's a new one, if it's an older piece of property, it's very common for there to be some issues. That's one thing. Another thing is like licenses. They need a rep and warrant that they have all the licenses to do the business they're doing. What if they were just cutting corners for 20 years and they were just never caught? You know, which with smaller business isn't actually an absurd thing to conjecture, to sort of think as having taken place. You know, like, oh, just no, there was such a small business, nobody came around and checked. And so, you know, the licenses, they didn't have them in place. You're doing the business. Now you realize you can't actually do your business. So getting the license is actually really difficult, or depends on the industry, obviously. And so if it's just some simple, very simple stuff, that's not necessarily an issue, but you know, a license is a very big deal. Another one. Yeah. So that's some points. Now I'll toss it back to you.
So I love, okay, two things. One, that was gold, because I think touching on even just broadly defining the reps and the warranties and some of these indemnification clauses, I know on our team, we talk about it all the time. Half of it goes over my head, to be frank, but I do my best to understand how we're mitigating risk. And that section is about, to my understanding, mitigating risk in a transaction. You gave some gold there, I think. And at least if nothing else, when folks are talking to their counsel or their lawyer, you at least know to, hey, are we thinking about reps, warranties, and indemnification? Are we thinking about how to mitigate the risk of the transaction? Worthwhile stuff for us deal makers to at least be wary of. It for a second, I was kind of scratching my head because maybe I misspoke, but I thought I was asking you about subscription agreements and raising equity. And then you talked about reps, warranties.
Oh, you were talking about in raising equity. I was talking in relation to buying the vehicle or buying the entity. Oh,
so what I'll do is I'll clip in. I'll put in something to say like, this is about negotiating the reps, warranties, and because I think the way we went back and forth, there was a tad crossing of the wires, but it was gold and it should be here. So I appreciate that. I don't want to take all day of your time. This is taking. I mean, these topics are. That's why I was laughing when we started going, looking at this menu of topics. Like, shoot, this is not light work. We're talking about a lot here. That was gold. It gave a great kind of overview. Maybe the last topic before we wrap, because I don't want to take up your whole night. It's a Friday, but maybe the last.
I'm stacked for the rest of the day too. So I appreciate your consideration.
Yeah. Corporate lawyers tend not to just have these real mild days. Let's do one last quick broad stroke. Could you give a 5-minute, maybe talk about 506B versus 506C and listing like the risk factors for investors when raising equity? I don't know. I kind of lob tossed. Can you just touch on it real quick before we let you go?
Yeah. So sure. So just to be clear here, we're talking about private placements and we're talking about securities, Reg D. And, here's a few basics about this. In relation to raising capital, is the investor an accredited investor?
Yeah.
This is something that there's like a formula for it. The SEC just recently, within the last few years, broadened it to make it so that like you can really take advantage of it. Before, it was a little more strict. And so you want to know, is the investor an accredited investor? And you can go online, and it's SEC is very good about these things. They post on the website like the ABCs of how it's defined. What does that mean for you? You literally ask the investor to answer each of those questions. Now, your lawyer would do this, but you literally just ask the investor and you say, okay, can you please answer these questions? And it's a very clear yes or no situation. It's not too ambiguous. That's the way to approach that.
Okay.
Now, a second point in relation to this, to understand that a lot of people miss this one, is that when you have to go file your Form D or your lawyer files it, you have to file it you have to file it with the SEC on the Edgar filing system. And you all the Edgar, like the person's name, Edgar, okay. E-D-G-A-R. And you also have to file it in every state in which there is an investor that you raised funds from an investor in. So if you have an investor in Texas, an investor in New York, usually New York or California or something, right? And then you have to file it there too, not just federally. And why do you have to do that? Well, when you do that, you're exempting yourself from the state security laws, because there's both. We're talking about Regulation D here. That's federal, and there's also every state has their own securities law, and you have to satisfy both. But when you file a Form D, there's an exemption, which is that you can also file it with the state, and then you don't have to satisfy the state securities law. You get two birds with one stone situation. So that's something people should keep in mind. You don't want to be, I mean, I know in a lot of these smaller transactions, you know, you're not necessarily going to get in trouble, but that's not the mindset to have. You should kind of just check your boxes or have your lawyer do it. And I guess a final note there that I'd add in relation to that is, there is there's two notes. One thing to be aware of is, you know, are you publicly soliciting for investment?
Right.
Shouldn't be doing that. You know, like online posting, like, hey guys, I'm just raising something. You know, this the internet changes this area quite a lot.
Yeah.
Are you publicly soliciting investment? Call your buddies up who's an investor. Don't necessarily post all over the internet. Don't necessarily post something on your website. If you have a website, you know, be considerate of that issue in itself. Like publicly, what does that mean? That means, well, there's a strict definition for it. But to kind of just speak in very layman's terms here, it's you're talking not just to people in private. That's the opposite of it. So like if you're on Shark Tank or something, or not, give another example. If you have an advertisement on the internet, like you're paying for an ad and you're saying, hey, come invest in this vehicle or whatever. Talking about like a special purpose vehicle when I say vehicle, not a car.
Right.
Come invest in this. You're running an ad. I know that most of the audience is probably not doing that, but people do that. And it's something to keep in mind. That's definitely public. And so you're not going to be getting one of these exemptions. And each of these exemptions is different. And the last thing I'll note is that if they're not an accredited investor, you can still get a different exemption. It's like the Section 4A. I'm not going to pull up my stuff, but I think it's the Section 4A or something. There's actually many exemptions. These are just some of the common ones for private placement. There's actually many different exemptions. If you're doing an exchange offer, you're giving them shares and they're giving you shares, there's a whole different exemption. There's several, there's more than 10. The general rule, just to kind of cover why are we talking about securities law and exemptions. Well, if you don't satisfy an exemption, then you have to register your securities. Registering securities is a lot of work. It's a second option. It's not your go-to plan. I'm not trying to say it's a bad thing, because it's not a moral issue. It's just like A or B, and A is way easier and way less expensive. And A is satisfying an exemption, and there's several of them, so you should kind of check what they are. And the most common ones are the ones we're talking about here under what's called Reg D, and the form that you have to file. There's a different form you have to file based off your situation, is Form D. So is that what you wanted me to touch on? Because I feel like there's a lot of stuff. Because like I said earlier, securities law is opening. A big area,
big can of worms. No, I think you hit the. I mean, look, to put it, to try to paraphrase, there's a lot of considerations here. You can't just go out and raise equity from someone and like have them wire you $100,000 and then you're off. Like there's more to it than that, and that's where having someone like Joe is meaningful on your team. or to have that counsel. I know, and the reason I brought up, I think what is referenced, or at least I reference, is 506C is like the more broad solicitation. Like there's a lot of, you can't just go on a microphone and broadcast your investment without, you know, there's ways to be a little bit more outspoken about it, is my understanding, but you have to be real particular about they be accredited, that you file correctly, that you can't just, you know, and maybe I don't want to, I know you got to go soon, I don't want to put you on a path where you can't comment, but there's a lot to it, is my understanding. I'm not a lawyer, that's why we have Joe, but you know, there's a lot to it.
Yeah, the 2013 Jobs Act has on a different changes, and there's just different ways you can go about raising equity funds. And that's kind of the way to think about it. It's like, well, what do I want to do? And then what are the different exemptions? Because each exemption is very different. You're allowed to do different things, whether it's public solicitation, whether it's with an accredited investor or a non-accredited investor. So those are kind of the key things you kind of have to keep in mind when you're thinking of raising equity. And again, securities is it is a big can of worms. And that's why I'm going to leave it at that, because, you know, it's if you look at the Securities Act, you know, sit down for about 6 months if you want to understand every piece of it. That's how complicated these things get.
Yeah. We'll see you at the next Olympics. That's useful. Look, I want to let you go, help you go, put some billable hours on the board, if you will. Where can we, first of all, thank you. Personally, and I know the audience will agree, I mean, you just came here and shared a ton of insight. I really want to say thank you. Where should the people go, those who are qualified, that are looking, who are you serving? Who's your ideal customer or client? And where should they go to learn more about you, or to work with you, or to get more in contact with you?
Thanks. And hey, it was a pleasure talking to you. It was real nice.
Yeah.
And it's fun to be able to have the chance to talk about something that you're behind a desk indoors all day. To be able to do something that's a little more like this is definitely really fun. So I appreciate you having me on. Where can people reach out to me? Well, my email address is joe@principe.com. That's PRENCIPE.com. And so you can email me directly. Who do I represent? Well, if you're buying a business, even if it's a small business, like $2 million, we do represent those, the microcaps, the small businesses too. Our typical transaction is 10 to 20 million. And we specifically represent and are focused on acquisition entrepreneurs, whether it's your first time or your nth time. We take an approach where we're guiding people and educating them along the process and making them aware of the issues as we go along, sort of this very mentor style mentality. And so you could email me directly. We have a website. You could check it out. Optimist Legal, like optimist as opposed to pessimist, not Optimist Prime. That's not what it is. And optimistlegal.com, no punctuation marks or anything. And that's our website, you know. But you can reach out to me at my email is fine. And that's about it, frankly. I think this time was well spent. I think we definitely hit off on a broad range of topics. And there's a lot to it. But I feel like we were able to kind of keep people alarmed or ring the bell a little bit on, hey, here's some things to don't just think it's paperwork and not want to do it.
Yeah. So I love that. I agree. And again, appreciate it. I've had a good time. It's been fun. I learned some things here, took some notes. I think everyone here, if you've been paying attention, there's a lot to learn. We'll get this thing uploaded and I will contact you when it goes live. But for the sake of letting you get back to it, hey, thanks for everything. And I appreciate it.
No, I thank you too, Jason. All right, let's keep in touch. We'll talk to you later.
All right, partner. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Later.
Hey, it's Jason Rogers. Thank you so much for watching the video. Be sure to subscribe, thumbs up the video, and for more, go to jasonpaulrogers.com.